From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump is promising a quick response to the chemical attack in Syria over the weekend, which the White House says was carried out by the Assad regime. The president spoke during a cabinet meeting this morning.
We are studying that situation extremely closely. We are meeting with our military and everybody else, and we'll be making some major decisions over the next 24 to 48 hours.
Syria and its ally Russia deny there was a chemical attack. Let's get the latest from the BBC's Lena Sinjab, who joins us now from Beirut. Lena, what more do we know today about this attack?
Well, no news yet. We know that the UN Security Council is due to meet today in New York to discuss this issue. There were strong statements coming out from President Donald Trump and France and even Britain, blaming the government of being responsible behind this attack. What we know so far is that, on Saturday evening, over the weekend, we've started receiving images and information from Douma. This is the last rebel-held area in eastern Ghouta. Of bombardment, but also of, some sort of chemical attack. And the images that came of a whole family suffocating with foam coming out of their mouth really indicates that there was some sort of a gas being used.
Now, Russia is saying there was no trace of a chemical attack. Is there any evidence to support that?
Well, the doctors, independent doctors, whether the ones who are working on the ground in Syria or experts who are watching the images, do confirm that there was a chemical gas used, probably chlorine gas, they're suggesting. But if we go back to recent experience, a year ago, there was a chemical attack in Khan Sheikhoun, and the government and Russian denied. They even blamed the rebels of using chemical weapons against their own areas. But later on, with independent investigations, it pointed the fingers clearly to the regime of being behind this attack. We know that all the bombing on this area, the last rebel-held area, which is Douma, is definitely coming from government areas, so there's no one else to blame for that.
The government has a motivation to get those final rebels out of that area, and perhaps, unfortunately, they tried to use a chemical to do that. Is there a presumption there where you are that now President Trump and perhaps France will be preparing for a military strike in response?
Well, the messages coming out are very strong and very clear. But, learning from recent experience and, especially the U.S. President Trump wants to pull out of Syria. So now is he going to really involve in a military operation? Mm-hmm. Last year after Khan Sheikhoun, the U.S. military forces, they did, an attack just to show that they stand for their own words. But there was no harm to the army, no harm to the Syrian government. Basically, it didn't change the course of the situation, and Assad did not stop his atrocities on Syrian people. So the question now is whether the Americans and the French will do something to stop this and change the course of events inside Syria. It's very much unlikely with Russia on the ground backing Assad.
Right. There was an airstrike on a Syrian airbase today. Russia and Syria say it was Israel that was responsible for that. Are you hearing anything from Israel on this? And why would Israel be motivated to get involved right now?
Well, Israel has been conducting airstrikes in Syria since 2012, and there were many of them. And rarely the Israeli government came out to confirm that they are behind it. But this specific airbase, which is a T4 airbase in Homs, was also targeted by the Israelis in February this year. And we know for sure that it is not only a military base, but it's a base for Iranian militias, Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and their affiliated militias like Hezbollah and the other Shia militias. So that's the main target for the Israelis. For them, it is important to stop the Iranians from expanding and sending missiles to Hezbollah. And we've learned also that the Iranians came out today to confirm at least three of their officers were killed in this airstrike, which is unprecedented for Iran to come out and confirm casualties.
So you don't see it any connection between the chemical attack, a response to the chemical attack? Perhaps maybe it's Israel just seeing an opportunity to jump into the fray.
I don't think there is any connection at all. It just happened that the timing right after the chemical attack, I don't think the Israelis has any intention to fight Assad himself, but rather limit the expansion of the Iranians.
Now, you mentioned the Iranian casualties. What is the feeling there in the region right now as all of this is happening simultaneously? Is there some unease now that all of this may be escalating?
Well, yes, definitely, indeed. I mean, this is a region that has always lived, you know, escalations and wars and conflicts and regional ones. But the recent developments inside Syria are really worrying, especially for regional countries like Lebanon, where Hezbollah is based and it's bordering Israel. There is real fear of escalation and that the war won't be contained within the borders of Syria only.
That's the BBC's Lena Sinjab speaking with us from Beirut. Lena, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, here in this country, there are 2.5 months left in the Supreme Court's term, and we're waiting on some big decisions, one with implications for public sector unions, another that could legalize sports gambling across the country. There are also some cases that have yet to be argued, including a challenge to President Trump's so-called travel ban. Emily Bazelon is staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Hi, Emily.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And let's start with Trump versus Hawaii. This is the case over the president's travel ban that puts restrictions on people coming to the U.S. from a number of countries, including Chad, Iran, Libya, North Korea, and Syria. What is the court looking at?
Well, this is the third version of the administration's travel ban, and we probably all remember back to the beginning of the Trump administration when the first travel ban caused a very chaotic rollout in the nation's airports, and there were a lot of accusations that this was really a Muslim ban. Since then, the administration has tried hard to clean up the order that it issued, and now we're talking about restrictions that vary from country to country, but for the most part, the citizens of the countries that you named are forbidden from emigrating to the United States, and a lot of them are barred from working or studying or even taking a vacation here.
And what's the status of the ban right now? It's had been to a number of courts.
Exactly. It's sort of mixed. The Trump administration has lost in some of the federal district courts and in the Ninth Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals on the West Coast. But in December, the Supreme Court allowed this third version of the Trump administration's travel ban to go into effect. So the legal challenge is still very much alive, and that's why we'll have arguments at the end of April in front of the Supreme Court. But in the meantime, the Trump administration had this interim important victory before the Supreme Court. And that victory suggests that there may well be five justices on the court who are willing to rule in Trump's favor in June when this decision is expected to come down.
Another case that goes before the court next week gets to the heart of online shopping. This is a case that stems from a 2016 law in South Dakota that requires out-of-state online retailers to collect state sales tax. Tell us about this one.
So in the early 1990s, the Supreme Court barred states from forcing companies to collect sales taxes if they don't have a local physical presence in the state, the kind of traditional bricks and mortar stores. But a lot of the states have been complaining about that ruling. They're complaining about, you know, the billions of dollars in lost sales taxes to online merchants. And some of them have been effectively skirting the Supreme Court's decision. So the South Dakota law that's at issue in this case taxes almost all of the goods and services from retailers. And the state wants to keep doing that, and other states want to do that too. The challengers to South Dakota's law say that the big online retailers like Amazon already collect sales taxes from their customers. And so these state laws really affect the smaller players who are just getting started online. But, you know, if you're a brick and mortar store in South Dakota or any other state, you don't want the online retailers to have an advantage of not collecting sales tax.
Emily, we always get a lot of decisions in the final weeks of the term, and we're expecting a big one on partisan gerrymandering. Tell us about that case.
Yeah, this is actually two cases. One of the cases is a challenge to the redistricting map in Wisconsin. The Republicans drew that map. This is the state assembly that we're talking about. And they heavily favored Republicans to win in the way that they drew the lines and divvied up the voters. The second case is in Maryland, and it's very similar, except this time it was the Democrats drawing the map, giving an advantage to Democrats in the congressional races. And so the kind of basic question here is, do courts have a role in policing the boundaries of partisan gerrymandering? Should people challenging these kinds of maps be able to go to court and get relief from judges? The Supreme Court has never really granted that kind of remedy before, has not let partisan gerrymandering be something that courts make decisions about. And so that's a huge political question before the court right now.
And it would have an impact in the 2018 elections or 2020?
It would have an impact in 2020, mostly, when the census happens again and the states redraw the maps. But in these particular states, it could also, yes, have an impact in 2018. And there's also a map in North Carolina that's at stake here. So the political stakes are really huge.
Just a few seconds left here, Emily, but there's always speculation about whether Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's 81, will retire. Is that what are people saying?
There is some talk of that. It's hard to tell how seriously to take it. Publicly, it's come from Dean Heller, the Nevada senator. Not clear why Senator Heller would really know anything about this. I sort of get the feeling that it's low-level chatter and maybe is just being bandied about in an effort to push Kennedy off the court if you think that you want Trump to replace him. But it's just so hard to tell about this kind of speculation.
Emily Bazelon, a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. I'm sure we'll be asking you that question again. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Huntington Beach, California, is joining the Trump administration's opposition to the state's sanctuary policies. The federal government is suing California over three state laws meant to protect undocumented immigrants. Back in the 1990s, California was waging its own fight against people living in the country illegally through Proposition 187, which would have denied them most public services. Voters actually backed the measure, but the courts struck most of it down. That fight transformed the state's politics and people's identities as Californians. Farida Jabala Romero of KQED has the story of how a protest against Proposition 187 changed lives in a community near San Jose. And a warning, this piece contains offensive language.
Back in the early 90s, Californians were going through a brutal economic recession and lost hundreds of thousands of jobs. The state's Latino population had doubled in just two decades. Racial tensions bubbled up in the town of Morgan Hill, south of San Jose.
That was the very first time in my life that I was called a wetback. And these are kids that I went to school with since kindergarten.
That's Amparo Cid. She was in fifth grade when Prop 187 was being debated. Former farm worker Jose Montemayor was a naturalized U.S. citizen. But he says his American wife and kids were treated like second class. Montemayor says at the neighborhood park, Latino and white families kept their distance. And at their church, Father John Pedigo says he and another priest got hate mail for speaking up against Prop 187.
Saying they didn't like what they heard, you know, at the pulpit because we were talking about immigration or we're talking about immigrants or we're talking about rights. You know, people were calling us communists or socialists or you guys are terrible people.
For Californians who work hard, pay taxes, and obey the laws, I'm suing to force the federal government to control the border.
Supporters of the measure, like then-Republican Governor Pete Wilson, argued illegal immigrants were draining the state of millions of dollars.
Enough is enough.
Governor Pete Wilson.
Latino U.S. citizens worried they'd be racially profiled at schools and hospitals. Nancy Gonzalez was 14.
You know, you look Latino, so we're gonna look further into your background, immigration status, and that's a violation of your rights. You know, that's a violation of privacy.
All these Morgan Hill residents wondered, if they didn't stand up to Prop 187, what would come next? Father Pedigo was so frustrated, he came up with an idea to push back.
So we're going to take a cross, and we're going to walk to the cathedral.
The cathedral in San Jose, 20 miles away. Parishioners like Jose Montemayor helped organize. He got a friend with a radio show in Spanish to publicize. People made signs that read,
No a la discriminación, no a la injusticia.
No to discrimination, no to injustice. The marchers met at a rundown parking lot near Morgan Hill's downtown. Today, there's a strip mall with a dental office and construction next door.
It looks like they're building apartments, some housing.
In the morning of October 25th, 1994, Pedigo was wearing his white clerical collar, black shirt, and Birkenstocks.
I don't think I owned any shoes at the time.
They began walking north. Pedigo and I drive on the route they took as they left town, along a highway. We pass apricot orchards, packing plants.
here, right where these trailers are. We're getting a little bit disheartened because it's like halfway to San Jose by now, and we're getting very tired.
It was hot. They got blisters. But as they passed neighborhoods and other parishes, people offered food and water. Others joined. The group swelled to 200.
It was beyond anything I hoped for at this point. We were committed to a march.
Nancy Gonzalez marched holding her little sister's hand. She felt proud.
We're out here, we're marching. We may or may not make a difference, but people are definitely going to see us.
By sunset, they saw the tall buildings in San Jose's downtown.
People are really getting excited. I'm getting kind of excited. I no longer am thinking about how hungry, tired, and bloody my feet are.
They saw another crowd as they approached the cathedral, filling a park, filling the streets.
Some of us started running. You know, there was a big group of people there. I don't know where they came from, but it felt like a big welcoming.
Word of the protest had spread, and somewhere between 2,000 and 10,000 people were there. One of them was Teresa Castellanos, a fourth-generation American. She was a young mom and union organizer. She brought all her three kids with her.
To say we stand together and we support each other and we're a community here that contributes.
Finally, Pedigo and the Morgan Hill marchers walked up the marble steps of the cathedral. Inside, it was packed. People held candles.
I get emotional thinking about how we all looked at each other. No one recognized that there was people power in the immigrant community and their allies. We didn't know we were that powerful.
In the decades that followed, that sense of power stayed with the marchers.
It changed my life, basically.
Nancy Gonzalez, Jose Montemayor, and their families still live in Morgan Hill, and they vote in every single election.
Even if I didn't have a voice back when I was 14, as soon as I turned 18, then I had a lot of responsibility.
Amparo Cid became an attorney working on social justice issues, a decision she links directly to her experience as a kid with Prop 187. She says today's kids are paying attention too.
They are watching and are hearing what's happening and what's coming out of our federal decision makers. And those kids are going to grow up to be phenomenal agents of change.
Father Pedigo now directs advocacy for one of the largest nonprofit agencies in California's Santa Clara County. And Teresa Castellanos has worked for 23 years to promote citizenship in immigrant communities.
And I think what we're fighting about in this country right now is the definition of what is an American.
She says as other parts of the country deal with economic anxieties and racial tensions, California found a way.
And I think the lesson that California has is that when you are inclusive, when you grow with your community, when you acknowledge a diversity, that is an asset. We are the richest state in the nation.
And a state that is more comfortable with a multicultural identity than earlier in its history. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
And Farida's story comes to us from a nonprofit media collaboration called California Dream.
Well, Peter, this morning it was cold.
Mm-hmm.
35 degrees in New York, 30 degrees in Chicago, 22 in Minneapolis, 38 in Amarillo, Texas, and 33 degrees in Medford, Oregon. It is April 9th, but in much of the country, it still feels a lot like winter. And joining us now to talk about that is Dale Eck, who is the director of the Global Forecast Center at the Weather Channel. Dale, it's been one of the coldest first weeks of April on record in the Midwest. It's also been cold in the East. Why?
Yeah, well, what ended up, we got a shift in the jet stream pattern as we moved into the month of April, actually at the end of March. We had a lot of storms, snow through the second half of March. And it was all due to a jet stream dip that came down out of Canada. So the jet stream was actually coming from northern Canada down into the Midwest and into the northeast part of the country. So it is that dislodging of the cold air from the poles that brought the cold into the eastern part of the United States.
How unusual is that?
It's not that unusual. what we tend to see during the spring and the fall months is the atmosphere is battling. The cold's trying to come south while it's trying to warm up. So usually during the spring, you typically don't get an average day. You're either going to be above average or below average. But what has been anomalous about this is that we have been locked in this pattern for several weeks. So everyone's just tired of it, and it's dramatically colder than average, and people are ready for spring to get here, and it actually is going to get here this week.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, it is April, and I remember a time when April was springtime, and this doesn't feel like spring at all, but when is the warm weather coming?
By the time we get to Friday of this week, much of the central and eastern United States is going to be a good 20 degrees above average. I think we're going to be looking at highs in the 70s in Chicago, Detroit, and even New York City. So we're definitely going to get a shot of good spring weather. The problem is it's not going to last. It looks like the cold's going to return again this weekend.
This cold, like we're talking in the 30s?
Yes. Yes, there's a pretty wow. There's going to be a, believe it or not, as we go through this week, there's going to be a strong storm coming out of the Rockies, and out ahead of it, it is going to warm up across the central and eastern U.S., and everyone's going to feel, oh, this is wonderful, this is terrific, and then a blizzard's going to come through the northern plains and the northern Great Lakes, and that's going to tap the Arctic air one more time. So as we head through the weekend and into early next week, we're going to be back down into these cold temperatures. I don't know if they will be record-breaking, but some records could fall once again as we head to next weekend.
Now, some people are going to be listening to this and they're going to say, isn't this climate change?
It is related to climate change. So when I talk to people about how, you know, you'll get these cold spells and people say, what are you talking about climate change? It's so cold, we're getting record cold, but there's just less cold to go around. So if you look at the whole, it's not U.S. warming, it's global warming. So the globe as a whole is warmer, but there still are pockets of cold, and those do get dislodged in the wintertime and in the springtime. And they, unfortunately, we had one that sat over the eastern United States for several weeks, and we're just all tired of it.
That's Dale Eck at the Weather Channel. Dale, thank you.
You're welcome.
So we'll get a little bit of warm weather later this week.
About 3 out of 4 millennials in the United States are in debt. According to a recent NBC poll, 3/4 of people 18 to 34 owe more than $30,000. 11% are more than $100,000 in the red. Credit card debt is the most common type of debt for this demographic, and only 22% of millennials have no debt at all. And using a credit card is about to get a little bit easier. This month, you can say goodbye to a staple of the industry, the signature, NPR's Matthew Schwartz reports.
Sign your way around the world with Diners Club International.
Ever since credit cards hit the scene in the early 1950s, shoppers have been signing on the dotted line. But starting this month, the big four credit card companies, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover, are no longer requiring signatures for most purchases. Bill Hardikoff of LowCards.com explains why.
In October 2015, credit card issuers started putting chips inside their credit cards. And those chips were a security feature that made transactions with credit cards much more secure.
Hardikoff says chips make it extremely difficult for criminals to create counterfeit cards, so fraud is way down. Plus now, credit card companies routinely monitor purchases and can see in real time if it appears a purchase doesn't match the shopper's habits. Still, Hardikoff says that those signatures did provide some security benefits at one time.
Clerks actually used to verify that your signature matched what was on the back of your credit card. It was a very secure feature.
But as customers started leaving smiley faces instead of a John Hancock, and clerks became lax, the signature requirement became less and less effective. Security consultant Robert Siciliano never thought it offered real protection.
I've always looked at the signature as a complete and utter false sense of security that has virtually no security value whatsoever. At best, the handwritten signature is good for assigning liability when there's loss. Other than that, there's nothing preventing anyone from forging anyone's signature.
And it's not like most retail clerks are trained in handwriting analysis. As a teenager, personal finance writer Jana Herron worked at a mall where she tried to compare signatures to the back of the card.
I always wondered, I'm not an expert in forgery. How am I supposed to know if this is the...
But don't put away your pen just yet. Credit card companies may no longer ask for a signature, but individual merchants can still require it. And one group in particular has a vested interest in making sure you spend a few minutes staring at that receipt.
I think restaurants were the big question mark because the tipping portion is so much a part of the signing of the receipt. And I think they really don't want to disturb the status quo. You don't want to have very confused diners going, what am I supposed to do?
So diners, you'll still be haggling with friends over splitting the bill, struggling with your conscience about how much to tip, and signing that receipt. For NPR News, I'm Matthew Schwartz.
What do we really know about Robert Mercer, the influential donor in conservative politics who helped President Trump get elected, the New York billionaire behind Cambridge Analytica, the money behind Breitbart News? Well, it turns out he and his son-in-law are also former volunteer members of a police force in a small New Mexico town. And reporter Zachary Miter has been looking into that part of the story for Bloomberg Businessweek. He's been covering Robert Mercer for the past 2.5 years. Zach, welcome.
Glad to be here.
How did a guy in his 70s from Long Island, New York, get to wear a badge in this postage stamp-sized town in Lake Arthur, New Mexico?
So Robert Mercer is really interested in guns. We know that he's a supporter of Second Amendment gun rights. He has a pistol range in his basement. And it seems to be that Lake Arthur, New Mexico, this tiny town in rural New Mexico, was essentially a way for Mercer to get a police badge, which would allow him to carry a concealed weapon anywhere in the country.
And he went to this little town. As you say, it's tiny. Population 433. You write that it's a town so small that it has no stores. I mean, what's his life like there? He's interacting mm-hmm. with the police department. He's got, you know, a sheriff in charge. What's going on?
Sure. So it's a very unusual police department there. There's, you know, Chief Will Norwood is the sole kind of, full-time person there. He's got a couple of part-time officers who help him out. And then he's got this huge number of reserve officers. And these are people from all over the country, people like Mercer, who don't really have any ties to Southeast New Mexico at all, who sort of volunteer their time. And in exchange, they get this badge, which makes them full law enforcement officers, allowing them to carry a concealed weapon at all times.
Did Robert Mercer go on patrol in this town?
So we asked the police department about what his actual contributions were, and they insisted, without really giving much detail, that he met the requirements of being a police officer there, which involve, you know, a minimum of 6 days of patrol per year. We didn't get any records that would verify that, but they insisted that for most of the time he was a police officer, he was fulfilling those requirements.
You write about some of the training that these reservists may have gotten, and that there's sniper training, there's training in how to blast a hole through a door, and you kind of make this point that it looks more like something that a bunch of guys who love guns would be participating in rather than something that could ever conceivably happen in this tiny town called Lake Arthur. So, I mean, were they getting legitimate police training?
So some of the training was obviously not what you would expect the first thing to teach volunteer kind of backup reserve officers in a small town, sniper training that's essentially like for urban warfare. So it seemed like an aspect of this program was that it was just kind of like a club for guys to do cool stuff. A lot of them are former Navy SEALs. They're people who are in the firearms industry, and many of them are also professional bodyguards, people who, you know, provide executive protection for corporate CEOs and rich people, things like that.
So you've alluded to this idea that Mercer could have done this because he wanted permission to carry a concealed weapon anywhere in the country. There is this law, 2004, Congress passed. It's called the Law Enforcement Officers Safety Act, which essentially codifies that.
That's right. And so what I'm describing in Lake Arthur is you could almost think of it as a loophole in the sense that when Congress passed this in 2004, the idea behind it was to protect officers' safety, police officers' safety, and maybe also the general public by having officers make it easier for off-duty officers to be armed.
You know, after this law was passed, there was some criticisms of police forces around the country, I understand, that were handing out these badges like the ones that Robert Mercer got, calling them badge factories. I mean, is there any evidence that shows that that's exactly what was happening in New Mexico?
The New Mexico, you know, Lake Arthur Police Department insists they're not a badge factory. They say that they set up this program to help achieve the mission of the police department and that everybody who gets a badge has to do a lot of volunteer service to qualify. But there is a kind of financial aspect to the transaction in Lake Arthur because Mercer, a foundation that he supports, gave a grant to the Lake Arthur Police Department. And his son-in-law was also involved in setting up a nonprofit that helped direct tens of thousands of dollars to the Lake Arthur Police Department.
And Robert Mercer lives in Suffolk County, New York, Long Island, where it's very, very difficult to carry a concealed weapon no matter who you are.
That's right. I mean, there's this case that's famous in gun circles, a guy who in Suffolk County who applied for a concealed carry permit because he actually helped the FBI take down an outlaw biker gang. Huh. And some of these gang members were getting out of prison many years later. He asked, and you're supposed to prove extreme immediate danger. That's the threshold for getting a concealed carry permit. And the department actually ruled that he failed to prove that, and so they didn't give him a concealed carry permit. That's how hard it is to get one in Suffolk County, New York.
Did Mercer talk to you for this story, explain at all why he was doing any of this?
No, he's basically never talks to the press at all about anything. I don't think he's ever given an interview about his political beliefs, which are obviously, you know, the kind of the most newsworthy thing about him.
Well, he is this enigma in American politics who just sort of showed up on the scene relatively recently with the election of Donald Trump. And what else can you tell us about this man who is such a mystery? We know he loves guns. You've been laying that out for us. You know he owns a gun company as well. You've also described him as kind of like the most interesting man in the world, the guy from the beer commercials.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, what other light can you shed on Robert Mercer for us?
Well, so Mercer just seems to like to do a lot of very interesting things. You might say quirky. He supports a lot of like kind of fringe science ideas and has some very kind of unconventional views about economics. He wants to return to the gold standard. And so what I see is kind of the common theme in that and also in his business career as a hedge fund manager, as he's sort of a common theme in his life has been that he's always been skeptical of the conventional wisdom and has been kind of unafraid to do things in a totally different way. And, you know, backing Steve Bannon a couple years ago when Bannon was, you know, not really an important person in Republican politics is probably another example of that, and one that a bet that turned out to be, you know, incredibly successful and you know, foresightful.
How does Mercer's interest in guns influence his politics?
That's a great question and one that I'd love to ask him. I mean, clearly that's one of the things he cares about in politics. When he issued a rare statement with his daughter one time when he mentioned a few of his most important political priorities, and gun rights was among them. So that's clearly it. But he's interested in a lot more things in politics just than guns.
You've got to wonder if his positioning in American politics helps not only just his interest in guns as well, but his corporate, his financial interests in the industry itself.
That's right. So in addition to his kind of personal interest in guns, he also has investments in gun companies. He has a company in New York, in Nevada, that has that's kind of a gun dealer and has tried to kind of dabble in international arms dealing of small arms and ammunition. And he's also recently purchased a gun manufacturing facility in South Carolina that makes assault-style weapons. It's hard to know, though. I mean, it kind of looks from a business perspective like the election of Donald Trump would have been pretty terrible for business because, you know, getting a strong gun rights supporter in office like Donald Trump meant that the short-term demand for assault-style weapons really fell through the floor.
Right. Everyone rushed out when Obama was elected because they felt like the guns were going to be regulated.
That's right. And they might have continued that more if Hillary Clinton was in the White House. But with Trump, the pressure was kind of off and sales really fell. And, you know, one of the biggest gun makers in the country just filed for bankruptcy. And it probably hasn't been good for sales at Mercer's Gun Company.
Zachary Miter, a reporter for Bloomberg News, telling us this fascinating story about the billionaire Robert Mercer. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
And Zach says Mercer and his son-in-law left the Lake Arthur Police Department last September. We do not know if Mercer is still allowed to carry a concealed weapon. He could be if he found his way onto another police force. And that is exactly what Zach says he's looking into right now.
Mark Zuckerberg is on Capitol Hill today meeting with lawmakers ahead of what could be the toughest days of his career. Tomorrow, the Facebook CEO testifies before Congress, where he'll face public questioning about data privacy, political advertising, and Russian interference in the 2016 election. Here's Zuckerberg speaking to Ezra Klein of Vox last week.
We're really idealistic, right? And when we started, you know, I think we thought about how good it would be if people could connect, if everyone had a voice. And frankly, I just think we didn't spend enough time investing in or thinking through some of the downside uses of the tools.
Joining us to look ahead to tomorrow's hearing is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And how big a moment is this for Facebook?
This is very simply an existential crisis for Facebook. It is a moment that challenges not only Facebook's business model, but also, and here I really mean existential, it challenges the story that Facebook tells itself about its role in the world, about its purpose and its function as a company that does good in the world. I mean, Facebook tells itself, the story has been, that it exists to connect people. And it operates under the presumption that this connection is a positive force. And the overall theme of the last 18 months or 2 years of negative stories about Facebook is the dark side of connection. Yes, it's good when people are connected to information, but what if that information is false? What if it's propaganda? What if it is so-called fake news? And yes, it is good to connect users with companies that are selling them things that they might want. But what if that information that is being used to target people is being shared with nefarious third parties that are getting access to people's data in a way that is either illegal or extra legal? These are the questions that Facebook's connection has raised in the last 18 months, and it threatens the very existence of the company's business model.
And of course, at the center of it is the revelation that Cambridge Analytica got data from tens of millions of Facebook users, most of whom never consented to sharing their data with the political consulting firm. What kinds of questions are you expecting from members of Congress? And I wonder whether you think they're going to be tougher coming from the Republicans or the Democrats.
I think we're going to see three flavors of interrogation. Flavor number one is going to be, what did you know and when did you know it? The Cambridge Analytica scandal, we recently learned, was known to Facebook in December 2015. December 2015. So a question that Facebook is clearly going to face, that Zuckerberg will face, is why didn't you button this up 2.5 years ago? We saw Sheryl Sandberg actually struggle to answer this question on the Today Show. That's number one. Flavor number two is questions about regulation. There will be attempts, I think, from the far left, but I think maybe also from the right, to pin down Mark Zuckerberg to say, what sort of regulation do you think is appropriate for political advertising specifically or especially? And then number three, and maybe this isn't a flavor of interrogation, you're going to see condemnation. We've all been at conferences where somebody says, I have a statement and a question, and then they make a long, morally outraged statement and then end with a question mark. I think there's going to be a lot of that. These congressional testimonies are good ways to ask business leaders about their companies, but they're even better ways for politicians to stump for a national audience of millions of people and have their comments replayed over and over again on cable news. And I think you're clearly going to see, particularly people from the left, want to establish themselves as being, for the public and against large companies doing nefarious things with their data.
And do you expect Congress to actually follow up with regulation?
I do. Yeah, I do. I think in particular, this issue of political advertising is ripe for regulation. I think that right now, for a long time, Facebook has had generally one standard for advertising, whether that ad was being bought by J. Crew, an American political party, or a Russian propagandist acting on behalf of an American political party. And I think Facebook itself is beginning to recognize that one of these things is not like the other, yeah. Or maybe all of these things are not like the others, and therefore you need different standards, whether a shirt is being sold or whether a political organization is being sold.
Derek, Zuckerberg is not known for his public speaking. It was actually a little weird to see him today in a suit and tie instead of a t-shirt. Saturday Night Live had some fun with that this weekend when Alex Moffat played Zuckerberg on Weekend Update with Colin Jost.
Hi there, Colin. Begin eye contact. 2, 3, and away. Nailed it.
So Facebook has apparently hired a team of experts to prepare Zuckerberg for his appearance. He and Sandberg have been on somewhat of a charm offensive, as you mentioned. What does he have to do to win people over?
If people think that Zuckerberg's a robot, and he's not going to get, acting training in the next 48 hours to be able to help him from that. No one expects him to go full Oprah here. I think he needs to do two things. I have two words for Zuckerberg: apologize and specify. Apologize. I think chief executives always underrate how far apologies go in the public sphere, and then specify what went wrong and how are we going to fix it. This doesn't need to be Hollywood pathos. We just need contrition and a plan. And to Zuckerberg's credit, in his prepared remarks, which were released in advance of his congressional testimony on Wednesday, he's going to say, and I quote here, "It was my mistake, and I'm sorry. Right. I started Facebook. I run it. I'm responsible for what happens here." I think he essentially just needs to apologize and then say exactly how these crises will not happen in the future.
Derek Thompson at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now.